What a fantastic podcast we have for you today with Marcus, who has actually been running the longest standing podcast on longevity. He has written a book and he has some fantastic insights in for us on how to live the long and happy life. So let's dive on in. Welcome to the podcast. Today we are meeting with Marcus Pierce, who has actually an expert in longevity. Now, Marcus, we're obviously interested to find a little bit about your background, but you've written a book, you've been running a very long podcast, you've got over 650 episodes, and you also present at many conferences around the world on this topic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, great to be with you, Seton. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Well, I actually saw your, actually connected with you after I saw that you were presenting at a seniors living, I think, event. And I thought that looks really interesting, and I love connecting with people who are interesting. So thank you so much for chatting to me and to getting to know. And I am fascinated by this topic. It is something that, you know, I've been very interested in. I think you and I have a very similar story in some ways of what we've done and changed. So let's get into that. So, Marcus, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this area.
I never thought I'd be considered an authority on longevity and aging well. I was a cigarette smoking, binge drinking, sports journalist working at Channel 9, you know, 20 years ago now, believe it or not, and was just obsessed with sport. And then I met my wife, my now wife, Sarah, who's a health professional, and cut a long story short, I quit smoking after my 750th attempt, cut out alcohol, stopped eating meat, thought that being a raging vegan was the secret to living a great long life. Left the media, lived in Ireland for a year, and instead of going to Irish pubs, I started shaving with avocado because I thought being a vegan teetotaler who shaved with avocado was the only way to save the planet and to live a great long life. And then I was reading a book by John Robbins, the late John Robbins, sadly, who was the heir to the throne of Baskin-Robbins ice cream. Anyone that's had a Baskin-Robbins ice cream, he was the heir to the throne of the billion-dollar company. And he'd left the family business after his dad, Burt Baskin, had already died, and his dad, Irv Robbins, was in a world of ill health. And he left the family to become the preeminent vegan author on the planet. And in one of his seminal books called Healthy at 100, which I read in order to tell me how good I was being a vegan teetotaler, he referenced in the second page of the introduction, not even chapter one, a study done by the Yale School of Public Health with 600 people. And over the course of 20 years, Seton, it asked these 600 people questions such as you age, you become less useful. Agree or disagree? As you age, you realize your best years are behind you. Agree or disagree? As you age, you realize it's all downhill from here. Agree or disagree? And sadly, what this study found was that the people that had a disempowered view of getting older, the people that thought it was all downhill from here, the people that watched the movie Grumpy Old Men and thought that would be them, those people died 7.5 years earlier than the people who had an empowered view of getting older. The people that had a compelling reason for getting out of bed, the people that weren't so afraid of getting older, lived 7.5 years longer. And what was really inconvenient for me was that this study didn't measure their exercise levels. It didn't measure their wealth status or how many friends they had or what work they did. And it didn't measure their genes or their diet. All it measured was
purely mindset.
And all I was thinking was, if I'm a vegan that doesn't drink alcohol and shaves with avocado, I'm going to live forever. And sadly, many people think that you are what you eat, but I don't want to come across with too many inconvenient truths. If we are what we eat, why do the diet experts die prematurely? If we are what we eat, shouldn't the people with the healthiest diets live the longest? And most of us know people that aren't the healthiest and still live a bloody long time. The people that have an empowering view of getting older that then go into their life with a level of purpose seem to live the longest. And and that kind of was my epiphany moment back in 2010. And ever since 2012, I've been hosting the podcast 100 Not Out. And I believe we are Australia's, if not the world's, longest running podcast on longevity and aging well.
Amazing.
And that is the end of the story.
And by the way, I love the connotation there to the sports too, 100 and not out.
Yes, so anyone that knows their cricket will see the sports connection.
That's right. I've just picked up on that one finally, a bit slow on those things. All right, so that sounds really interesting. So you've obviously been, you know, you've met with hundreds and hundreds of people, you've done studies, you know, we were just having a quick conversation before and things, so I love these things, learning new things like the blue zones, stuff like that. So why don't you take us through a little bit of some of the things that you've discovered or found out over the last sort of 13 years?
Yeah, sure. So after that epiphany reading Healthy at 100, I called my good mate, Dr. Damien Christoph, who at the time had the number one health podcast in Australia called The Wellness Guys. And this was before radio stations kind of caught onto the idea of recording your shows and uploading them to iTunes. So independent podcasts used to kind of be the only podcasts. And then The Wellness Guys was number one. And I called Damo and I said, I've had this big awareness around longevity and aging. Well, do you want to do a podcast together? And he said, well, Piercy, it's my nickname. I'm 39 and I'm scared shitless of turning 40. So I'd be all in on a longevity podcast. And I said, well, I know we'll interview the vegans and they'll be the longest lived. And he said, nah, I reckon the people that eat anything, like the omnivores, they'll be the longest lived. And what we realized after literally our first 20 episodes is that people with terrible diets were actually living really good lives. Australia's oldest man, Dexter Kruger, I think he was 110 when we were interviewing him, and he'd have a coffee and cake at morning tea and a coffee and cake at afternoon tea and a coffee at midnight to help him go to sleep. And, you know, we'd interview people that are masters, athletics, gold medalists, and they'd celebrate their win with a donut at the bakery. And, you know, we'd interview centenarians winning world masters gold medals and they'd say, I don't eat vegetables. And I'm like, what? And so it really began to not confuse us, but really open ourselves up to like, longevity is not as simple as what you eat. And, you know, that was the beginning, I suppose, of really knuckling down on this research and really beginning to put some meat on the bone of this conversation of what does it take to age well. And so then from there, as the podcast kind of grew legs, we started taking small groups to the European Blue Zones, Ikaria, also known as the island where people forget to die, not in Korea, as many people think we're saying, Ikaria, as in named after Icarus, who lost his wings when they melted too close to the sky. Or to the sun, small Greek island, population 80% less dementia, 50% less heart disease, 20% less cancer. Incredible, incredible place. And then also Sardinia, where strangely enough, on planet Earth, for every 6 centenarians, 5 are women and 1 is a male. In Sardinia, it's 1-to-1. And that's a really interesting phenom because that just doesn't happen anywhere else. And so we've been taking people to those blue zones for 10 years. And then, as you said, doing a lot of speaking around the country and the world around what does it take to live a great long life. You know, that's a conversation that is too broad for today's episode, but it's a conversation that we all want to have now because we recognize that aging well is not just for a few people. It's not Tats Lotto to get old anymore.
This is now something that, you know, it's just tomorrow. It is possible. And I think it's the other thing I realized, you know, when you're in your 20s, you think you're going to live forever, right? And you think it's in that, you don't realize, you know, you're talking about your mate getting to 40 and I've just turned 40 this year and you think, oh God, you know, and things start to, my knee goes a bit and, you know, things start to, it's like, well, you're going to be older for longer than you're going to be young. You know, if you really got, if you're kind of like maturing and, you know, human brains don't really, and particularly if males don't mature to sort of 25, for women sort of around that 21 stage, you think about it, you kind of got 20 years in there and then you generally have kids, so you can say goodbye to half of that anyway with no sleep as well. And then it's like, then you're going to spend from 40, let's say, even if you, you know, to 80 to 100. So yes, it is about longevity, but then it's also about quality of life. And I'm assuming there is a very strong linkage between quality and also longevity as well.
Well, it's a pretty brutal conversation, to be frank, because to be really clear, the wealthier a nation is, the worse its quality of life is as people get older. And again, I know your audience has a fair corporate slant to it, so it's an important conversation to have because when we deal with money, we often think that money makes you live longer. But when we go to Ikaria and Sardinia and you're chatting with the locals that, you know, I'm just recently back from Ikaria and Sardinia and I still think of a 95-year-old Sardinian lady, Teresa, who doesn't have a washing machine. Her pathway is filled with like broken concrete that you think you'd slip and break an ankle on at any moment. She does everything by hand from scratch. And you ask her, what are the foundations of a great life, Teresa. And she'll say, do not be afraid of hard work. Do not be afraid of hard work. And the sad thing is, Seton, we now have best-selling books called The Comfort Crisis. We have mantras like drive, or why walk when you can drive. You go to airports and you see everyone on escalators instead of steps. We want everything to be easier and faster, and we are just addicted to efficiency. And if you really look for the secrets to a great long life, is we need to make our life a little bit harder. Because
the stoicism.
Stoicism, we can absolutely go down that path. But just
doesn't have to be, but I mean, you can see the emergence of that type of stuff too.
100%. Yeah, but it's more like the only way to create a level of stoicism or resilience or any term that gives that feeling is to actually have the guts and determination to make life a little bit harder, a little bit more inconvenient. You know, you don't get stoic from just driving to work all the time. You get stoic from, you know, some people come on our trips and they start walking to work, a 7-kilometer walk to work. Who walks 7 kilometers to work these days? I don't know many people. Some people would, but you look at e-bikes, you know, you look at scooters, you look at all these things that make our life more efficient, but on a longevity perspective, they're actually recipes for ineffectiveness because we end up with this morbidity, with this injury and illness that in wealthy nations is the worst. America has the worst morbidity on the planet, as in the end chapter to the movie called Life is about 12.4 years in America. So you have 12.4 years of injury and illness. Second on the ladder, silver medal for the worst end to the movie called Life is the little country, the lucky country of Australia, 12.1 years. At 70.9, it statistically all goes downhill. And at 83 on average, you are gone. And that is no way, with all the money and the opportunity and the choice and the freedom and the peace and the everything that makes us so happy to be Australian, that is no way to live a life. And I've never met anyone that would be quite happy to be that statistic.
So, and I'm absolutely sure there are reasons, you know, once you unpack that, right? Like, I would imagine if you say that to me about the US, the first thing came to my mind was they've got the worst health system in the world, nearly. Like, fortune you have to pay to be able to do that. But then when you say Australia is, I start going, is it because we all kill ourselves to live in a corporate life and then we suddenly do that, then we miss a part of a proportion? And I'm theorizing here, you can tell me from what you've learned. Yep. And then suddenly, what is our purpose beyond that? We live in a very, both Australia and America are independent social societies. So we are about the independence, but that means we don't have the social constructs of, you know, family around. Yep. And, you know, other countries will look after the elder. For us, we put people in a nursing home and then go and visit them every now and then and then think, you know, so I think there's a lot, you're very lonely. So is that, you know, that's right. We can buy fresh food and do all of that type of stuff, but those factors are probably, I'm imagining, an element.
Yeah, you can have a great diet, but if you don't like your job and you can't stand your family and you've got no friends, I mean, how good's your organic chicken salad, right? Like, it's not that effective. But to your point, you look at the newest Blue Zone, Singapore, which is offering $15,000 proximity discount when you buy a home close to your parents, because they know that's actually going to help your parents. It's going to give you some purpose, but it's also going to help your parents stay out of the healthcare system and so on. You can see that some of the world is catching on to this, but to your original question around why America and why Australia, again, I'm not here to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but we've got to be really clear when it comes to wealth. With wealth gives us equal opportunity, but also equal, danger. We can keep you alive for a very, very, very long time. And anyone that's got parents that have zero quality of life, this is brutal to say, but a lot of people I speak to are like, they're better off dead. They've lost all quality of life. So it's kind of like when you don't have the, dare I say it, like the nursing home culture. Again, I'm just back from Sardinia where it's almost sacrilegious to put your parents into a nursing home. It's like it brings shame upon your family. Now, that is changing to an extent in Sardinia, but in many ways, when you look after people at home, it actually reduces their morbidity, but it also reduces their longevity. They're dying younger with with in less pain or in less undignified life, but they're dying earlier. Whereas in hospitals and in nursing homes and with medicine and so on, just look at chronic disease. Like, we can keep you alive. We can keep the heart beating, even if you can't move your legs and you can't drive a car and you can't go here and you can't go there, but you're alive. And again, that's not to be pessimistic or cynical about the way society operates. I'm here to say, look, this is the game we're playing. If you're going to live in Australia, you don't want to retire on the pension because that's relative poverty. If you want any level of choice, if you're going to be on the pension, you've got to move to Thailand or Bali to feel like you've actually got some choice. It's the same with your health as you get older. You don't want to be stuck in the system with no freedom and no independence, because you'll just go down a slippery slope of losing dignity a month and a year at a time. So we've got to be really mindful of how we approach longevity in Australia, because it is different country by country. Cultural pieces, to your point, family, how close are your family? Do you live near your elderly parents? Do you have siblings? Can they help, or do they live overseas? It's a complicated conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
That's relevant to everyone.
Absolutely. I mean, it fascinates me because I think we have a very different culture in Australia, and Australia is very multicultural. So let's be honest with that too. But even at other stages in lives when people have children and, you know, and multicultural, like multi people who have people coming from overseas, particularly India, where they come out for multiple months and support them through that. Just, I suppose, there's a lot more support there, and that actually makes people feel a lot better. It's the same thing. It's like, it seems like we have a culture where that's it. You know, my family's very much like that. It was, oh, right, you're off you go. It doesn't mean we don't have a loving part, but it was like, we've done your job. You've got to go and do your independent life now. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's that term that we're sort of that sandwich generation too now, where you've got the kids at one end and then you've got the aging parents at the other end. And it is the hardest point. You're also at that point in your career where you've got to kind of go up and more pressure you know, all those types of things. But I think there is also, I think the one word you've used there that I find very interesting is choice. And I think it's one of the things that actually matters at all points in your life, right? When people are often miserable in jobs or they're miserable in what's going on, it's generally because they feel they don't have choice. Mm. I mean, I must say that, you know, I've made certain choices, right? So I run a business and I do that for many reasons. But one of those is also because I have choice for me to be able to drop off my kids in the morning, or this morning my father-in-law is here. So I was like, you know what? And I'm taking that time. We'll walk on the beach together, particularly as we may not get that time. And I think as your parents get older, you realize that. But that's having the ability to have choice. And I think that sometimes we forget, you know, we've got all these psychologically safe, you know, laws that have come in for WHS now. I think we also need to remember that as people get older. I think we get so much about caring for people, we forget about what to enable people for their choice. And I think it is harder. Like, so we have a dog that's aging and we're about to put him down. My dad's a vet, so we can choose when we want to kind of do that. And he's getting to the point, his legs are going and summer's just come, so he's a bit more sprightly for the next, well, where I live, summer's come. So you and I aren't far from each other. Yeah. But we had that conversation and it was like, you can put the dog down and take him out of his misery because his life is not as pleasurable as it was. And you're sort of weighing that up. Whereas for a human, we don't necessarily, there is, and we'll get into a whole lot, area, but there isn't the same choice that once you start to, you can't necessarily choose easily in this country to be able to choose to get out, because there could be consequences for doctors and for family members, anybody who assists you in that. And I think that's a really difficult thing. Well, but I think also when you've got people who are aging, or we have somebody who's got dementia in our lives at the moment, is also that hard part you see this psychological effects of choice has on people.
Well, this is a pretty difficult conversation to have, but let's just go there because it's important. You mentioned dementia and so on, and there's a lot of research to suggest that dementia takes between 20 and 50 years to actually hit the diagnosis point. And we also recognize that 42% of all dementia would disappear if we were sufficiently physically active, which goes to that point of the comfort crisis and how sadly most people are not sufficiently physically active, which is 30 minutes a day. Now, I say this because my dad, my beautiful dad, my best mate, is 8 years into dementia. And at around my age, which is 44, he became too busy to exercise. He used to run 10Ks. I have childhood memories of watching my dad run and be active and so on. And then life gets busy.
Yeah.
He's working at News Limited, corporate world, lots of sitting, big hours, da-da-da-da-da. And there's a number of elements of my dad's life, but the physical activity being one of them, that I recognize that we don't want to wait until there's very little that we can do. You don't want to start looking after yourself and doing this aging well thing when you're 70. If you say in your 40s that you're too busy to exercise, too busy to socialize, too busy to eat well, too busy to have quality time with your family and your kids and your this, that, too busy to read a book, too busy to save, too busy to invest, whatever it is, the concept around time is one of the biggest limiting beliefs that humans have, but it's one of the biggest challenges that we have in Australia as our lifestyles speed up. Again, I'm just back from Icaria and Sardinia, where life moves at a very different pace.
Yes.
And one of the great challenges we have is, how do we bring a little bit of that slowness back to our lives? And the challenge is real. I think the most important thing is not to get sucked into this cultural conversation of how busy things are. When people say, hey, you're going, you're keeping busy, you want to say, no, life is full, but I'm not busy. Like, busy as a business person is a symptom of disorganization. It's a symptom of failure. I've interviewed many entrepreneurs that go, one of the biggest failures I've made in my business is being busy. It's not a metric of success, and it's not a metric of it's a terrible reflection on our ability to self-manage and self-regulate our lives. When you look at these cultures that do it well, busy is not part of the vocabulary.
Yeah.
You want a full life, full quality time with colleagues, friends, family, yourself, and so on. You want a lot of opportunities for rich experiences in the workplace and at home and so on. But busy is not a symptom of success. It's a symptom of failure. And we've got to be mindful of the consequences of that.
Yeah, I think I 100% agree with you. And I think it's one of the things that, you know, now I don't live in a capital city. And I was saying to somebody who was up the other day and, you know, showing them around, and I was like, one of the best things I like about where I live is then I can step out of the rat race, and it gives me the ability to strategically look at things. I'm also very lucky, you know, they say you're often influenced by the people around you. I have a very good friend who's probably influenced my life quite significantly in making choices. And, you know, for her, she's like, I work these hours, I want to be finished by this time. And I feel guilty when I'm not doing an 8-hour day, right? But then I think, but why? Why can't you just be more efficient or figure out, you know, again, I'm using a term there, but like, why do we have to do it in a certain way? And I think these days, you know, now with emails, with phone calls, with everything on your phone, I mean, we can get into the whole digital thing, the next generation, I think it's going to be massive. But I think the big thing is though, we don't slow down enough. Right? It was so busy and keeping our kids so busy and doing everything. We don't actually take time to literally smell the roses. Mm. The funny thing is that, and this is why I stopped doing what I was doing, I was totally burnt out, absolutely burnt myself out. And I see others doing exactly the same job I did, burnt out from, you know, having just those demands. And you think there's just a more efficient way. Now I was able to start a business to be able to design that more efficient way. But a lot of people, it's when we hit a flesh, and then it's like, oh, okay, we can achieve that much in this time. Right. So now we need to achieve this much work in that time. Whereas realistically, you know, for a business, it's just earning income and it's operating costs. But we seem to, you know, our cost of living is quite high. What we pay people is quite high. But, you know, in comparison to the global, you know, salaries. But in essence, we're expecting more and more and more and more for people for less and less and less, or that we expect, you know, and I work in HR, you know, that word is human resources. And it's like, you need to think about this as an out, like, what are you trying to achieve? And sometimes being out of the rat race or being not in it enables you to be able to, instead of reactionary, actually assess the situation. And I remember some of the best leaders I've worked with seem so calm. And I've looked at them, because when I'm, you know, I've got ADHD, so sometimes I'm manic, sometimes I'm calm. And I think the best leaders I've ever seen are the ones who are ultra calm and just look at the problem, take time, breathe, they talk slower, and then literally they just make a decision, and it's just so much more effective than the leaders who are running around in, you know, like me, in a manic state. This, and it just creates so much stress for everybody else around them. But that concept of time is there, right? Like,
well, I think, yeah.
But the outcome.
And a lot of people go on, sorry.
Go.
No, I was just thinking as you were saying that a lot of people are just scared to go slower because they think that it reflects poorly on their work ethic or they're not a cultural fit because we kind of go at this pace in this company and so on. But I wrote down, as you were saying, like, because particularly for people that are listening to this that are employed rather than employers, is very much people feel like that they exchange time for money. But as employers, we often want results for money. Like,
correct,
I'm paying you for results, but if there's a culture of I'm paying you to sit at this desk from this time to that time. Now, that's different if you are a receptionist, an EA, you're a courier or whatever it is. It's different. If you're flying a plane, well, the result is land safely, but then generally we know how long it takes to go to these places. So I think we've got to be mindful that depending on the nature of our life, because some people might be listening to this going, well, I live in a capital city. You and I both are, you know, somewhat regional. And so we feel we've got access to this perspective that we can slow down a bit more easily. But if people are listening to this and they're in, you know, Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide, Brisbane, Perth, and they're like, I'm just stuck in the suburbs, I can't relate to that. Well, there is, that's not the time to give up and go, well, that means I've got to go fast and do this. It's about finding elements, jigsaw pieces in your life where you can just go, on this Friday, I'm going to find a way to finish at 1 o'clock, or on this Monday morning, I'm going to drop the kids off at school and go get a coffee and start at 10 a.m. Whatever it is, it's these little nuggets. I remember interviewing a Holocaust survivor about how do you remain bright during the war? And she said, all I needed was a spark of happiness to keep me going, just a spark. And I often think about that because we often want this perfect life where we're on purpose. We've got physical vitality. All of our friends are awesome. We've got great health. We love our family. We're reading and we're playing the piano and we're learning French and we're spending less than we earn and we're spiritually aware and we're just on fire. I don't know about you, but that might happen once a lifetime, right? I reckon most of us are looking for like a spark to keep us on a piece of momentum or a path of momentum in any area of life. And I think when it comes to people listening to this right now, we're not saying overhaul your life in all areas of your life. It's like, look at what's well, and then what's not so great, just think of one little spark that can take you forward. Because
I think that's the thing, what you've just mentioned there is also about perspective, right? Like even before we got on this call, I was telling you of, you know, everything that I'm not feeling like, you know, drama that's been going on that I just can't get my rhythm, right? But we talk about this and that just makes you instantly start to change your perspective. You can choose to see all the chaos or you can choose to see the good moments in something. Mm. So that's definitely something. If anybody is interested in this area, I mean, this is actually what led to a lot of me changing my life as I watched a TV show called Limitless with Hemsworth on it on National Geographic, on Disney. And it, you know, went through all these different things. And one of the most interesting parts was when they strapped him with these things to sort of immobilize him, right? It's really mobile guy being immobile. And they actually had this point of that it is also about accepting where you are, right? So in that point, changing perspective and understanding where you are and seeing the good in that moment. And I think that's the one thing that time can't, that is a mindset thing. And sometimes when it comes to time, I find often the days that, and it's hard because I've, you know, got two small children running around doing these things. Even in my ideal days, get up at 4, doesn't happen as much. I'm off
the rhythm. Get up at 4 in the morning?
Yeah, get up at 4 a.m. in the morning. Yeah, it's the only way to get stuff done. You know, I get up at my ideal day is get up at 4 a.m., do my rolling out, then do a yoga session, then do a workout. You know, this morning I've had a brilliant morning. I went for, like, my morning's been brilliant. I didn't get up at 4 a.m. I didn't get my stretching in because I know I need to do that to keep more mobile because I'm now a little bit older, so that's important. Mobility and keeping strength is important. But the days when I get in a meditation session, and maybe it is because I'm ADHD that it helps more, but those days, that 10 minutes of that investment, right, whether it's sitting down and having coffee for that 2 to 5 minutes and being grateful for what you do, it's sometimes those micro habits. And so we interviewed somebody about micro habits. Those tiny things can actually pay a big difference. And I think that's also what you're talking about in look at these blue zones. It's probably the tiny little habits, right? And we can't control our whole life. We can't do everything. Stuff happens, right? But at the same time, what are the tiny little things that you might be able to do to change in that? As you said, walking to work versus that. But life's going to change. And what you think is going to be right today is probably going to be different to tomorrow. Mm. And so as you're saying, if you are in a situation where you can't, is it the micro moments that we can take that might actually add up to the big changes? And in that, I'm interested because obviously you've spoken to lots of different people and I'm sure you get lots of different opinions, right?
Well, I've always said there's two ways to change your life. You can change your beliefs or change your behavior. So sometimes your behavior is a great way to make shifts because that changes your beliefs. That's generally how I roll. But a lot of people, particularly like you said, you love to meditate. I'm not someone that has a real meditation practice, but meditation is great for giving you a shift in beliefs. And then that gives you a shift in behavior because you've shifted your beliefs. So it's just pick one and go for it, right? Just depending on how you are and what you like to do. But you look at people that live a great long life and they have great beliefs and great behavior. What came first? I don't think it really matters. It's more like just pick your path. And is it that you're going to start walking? Well, you'll start walking and then that will slow you down and then that might alter your beliefs around the pace of which you want to live your life. Or do you have a cup of tea and contemplate it? Do you sit down and meditate on it and shift your beliefs about how you want to, or do you talk it out with a friend or family member and really begin to see how your beliefs might be somewhat more malleable and then begin to adjust your lifestyle accordingly? You know, I don't want to be too waffly, but I also don't want to be too prescriptive because I'm, old enough to know that everyone does it in their own way, in their own time.
Yeah.
But I'd always just crunch it down to it's beliefs or behavior. You go and pick it. And then adjust your life from there.
Yeah. And so you wrote a book. And unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to listen to all of the book yet, but what are some of the leading principles and things that you cover off?
Well, essentially my book or my work is broken up into three areas. We have our longevity, our quality of life, and our heart and soul. So essentially, if you have three plans for your life, what's your longevity plan, what's your quality of life plan, and what's your heart and soul plan? And longevity in all of my research is your compelling reason to get out of bed each day. So that's your purpose. And again, we can talk that on a corporate level or we can talk that on a personal level, but I truly believe everyone has the same purpose and that is to help people. But how we help people is what makes us different. And then our physical activity, which gives us our vitality. Movement seems to be more important than nutrition for longevity. Too many people that have had the best diet but haven't been physically active have died prematurely. So you can put the best fuel in the car, but if you don't drive the car's going to die. And so that generally seems to come through loud and clear. And then our social activity is the third ingredient for longevity. So purpose, physically active, socially active, that's our longevity plan.
Yeah.
So they're the first three chapters of the book. And then the quality of life plan is our nutrition, not just what we eat, but how we eat, who we eat with, when we eat, why we eat. Again, no use having a kale smoothie by yourself, bored out of your brains and unhappy with your life. It's only going to take you so far. You're better off having a coffee and a piece of chocolate cake with your best friend and have a deeper meaningful about where you're at in life. Then you've got your family relationships, which there's five key relationships I discuss. The two above us is our parents and our grandparents. On a peer level, we have our intimate partner and our siblings. And then below, we have our children. And of course, not all of us, they're not relevant to everyone. And there's in-laws and steps and halves and cousins and so on. And then I talk about growth or fun or enthusiasm, you know, the hobbies that make you you. I love to play table tennis. I love reading. I love the piano and French. Someone else loves to play the trombone. So those things that make you you. And then the last piece in the quality of life puzzle is your wealth, spending less than you earn and investing the difference. And the wealthier a nation you live in, the more important that is.
Yeah.
So that's your quality of life plan. And then your heart and soul is your spirit. You know, if you don't put your heart and soul into your purpose and your movement and your friends and your food and your family and your growth and your wealth, everything becomes one big to-do list. And we have these buzz terms like mental load and mental fatigue and so on. And it's often because we've brainiac'd our life so much. We're like human being to the max, human doing to the max, but human being is like deficit, is bankrupt, is we've lost ourselves and we don't know who we are. And then we have to come to Byron Bay to find ourselves and then decide what we're going to do with our lives. So, you know, putting our heart and soul into every area of life is, that's kind of my exceptional life blueprint. It's a triangle inside a circle,
you know,
with those eight areas of life.
And that sounds brilliant. I've obviously done a lot of this and looked at longevity and things like this. And, you know, there's similar things in there, but it sounds like the way that you've actually, and I'll be now definitely listening to the book, so that's great. I'm just hoping to do it before we met. I think the way that you've sort of processed that down seems to be in line with most, you know, studies and things that are out there, but in it to a practical way. Right? It's really not that complicated, but there's lots of things that show. And then it's just about That sounds brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So what's the book called and how do people get to listen to it and learn these fantastic things?
Oh, yeah. The book's called Your Exceptional Life, Make the Rest of Your Life the Best of Your Life. You can, of course, buy it on Amazon and bookstores and so on. But yeah, it is available on audiobook, Spotify, Audible, all those places. Brilliant. Read by the author, which is my pet hate when a nonfiction book is not read by the author, because I love audiobooks as well.
I agree. So, I like to hear the words. I always listen a lot more to the person when they've actually read it themselves. So that sounds absolutely fantastic. And I think there's lots of things to take away there. And I think one of the things I've heard very loud and clear is it's not about thinking about this when you're in your 80s, mm-hmm. right? It's actually about thinking about this now, whether you're in your 20s, whether you're in your 30s, your 40s, your 50s or your 60s, because actually, you know, particularly on the wealth side, that is about embedding it earlier. And that's actually about behavior. You know, in my 40s, I'm like, shit, I've just lost 20 years where, you know, it's good at saving, but I wasn't thinking it as a percentage of things. Yeah. Now, hang on.
Yeah.
But then about, you know, the exercise thing's not, I'm just a natural person who needs to exercise every day to feel good and do all of that stuff. But I think that purpose part and then building that into what this looks like is really good. And I think that's something that we need to all be thinking about because, as I said, we are going to spend, like if I'm 40, I'm going to spend the next 40 years aging and I'm going to spend the next 40 years, you know, 20 years hopefully after that being at that final chapter. I'm not saying it is 80, but you're coming to those final chapters. And now watching your parents in their 70s doing that, it's very interesting. It's, you know, how you see a real change when people have been working and very successful in their careers and then coming to an end and watching that transition in themselves. And the ones who I see doing well, my mother, you know, she volunteers every day pretty much. My father-in-law volunteers. So there's a purpose there. There's those parts. But I think that's one of the things I've had an observation of a few things. One, unfortunately, I'm not religious. In some ways, I wish I was because I think that's faith and a community brings a lot of positivity and things to it. But I also think that, you know, we look at, you know, you talked about Greek, Italian cultures where family or other Asian cultures where family and community is an underlying element and people aren't as lonely because everybody is seeing each other. When you come over, you learn to cook together. You do that. That's part of it. Whereas I think for us, a lot of the time I observe that we're about, you know, having alcohol is a big thing in Australia, obviously, or you know, the old barbecue is just as good, but it's not quite the same, right? They talk about the Mediterranean diet, but obviously the community and connecting with that. And I think bringing that to a workplace's point of view, I think that's something that I was talking to somebody the other day and they were talking about that they had sat down, they tried this initiative they had from overseas where everybody came together over lunch, bring their own lunch, and they just facilitated questions. You weren't allowed to talk about work. The senior leaders and anybody could come and people walked away from that lunch like literally like, this is the best thing I've ever done. Right? Well, the best cultural event. Literally had a lunch and just brought people together and got them to discuss a few things. And that element of connecting on a human level, when you talk productivity, you talk engagement levels, and we do all these other things, that stuff just shows you how much of a difference it makes versus forcing everybody to be there.
Yeah. So yeah, it's poignant that you bring this up because again, I'm just back from 10 days in Icaria, 10 days in Sardinia. What's that? 20 days, 3 meals a day. 60 meals where you're literally around, I had 14 in Icaria and 16 of us in Sardinia, but 3 of the attendees in Sardinia were there on a corporate trip. They're on a professional study trip. And I'm going to read you a note that I'll keep anonymous, but to your point, I think this is the poignant you spoke about, you know, complexity versus simplicity earlier and people. This person says, you know, so this is, she said, this person says, this is kind of personal, a note that I was writing while I was on the trip and everything I couldn't say at the table. I did say I prefer to write over talking, but I'm still not very good at it. This person is very good at both. Story of my thoughts I wouldn't say at the table. I've just come back from Sardinia, walking and exploring through one of the world's blue zones where life lingers longer and slower and people seem stitched together by something invisible but undeniable. All throughout the trip, one truth kept rising to the surface. Community. Again and again, it shone through as the most important part of people's lives. Not their possessions, not their diet or exercise, not even their health alone, but the circle of family and neighbors, the bonds that outlast the years. And that, to your point, Seton, we're not looking for some fountain of youth that's full of some secret that's never been around. Like, the secret is staring us in the face, and it surrounds us either through its invisible nature, as in we are missing it so badly, like we don't have family and connection, to the point where we have a lunch with people and we talk about anything but work, and it's this profound experience. I mean, nothing is more embarrassing and amazing all at the same time. Do you know what I mean? When I interview centenarians, sometimes they're like, it's kind of embarrassing that you're interviewing me because I just think I'm a regular Joe, but because we're aging so poorly as a species, you need to interview people like me to show that it can be done well. It's the same with a lunch. So when we all eat together and we don't check our phones and we ask questions to each other rather than making statements, and we're interested rather than interesting, and we're eating healthy food and we're listening, like, that makes me feel really good. I'm like, yeah, isn't that remarkable? Like, don't you think? I mean, we're all looking for
the most laughing because it is. At the end of the day,
before breakfast is the secret to longevity, and it's staring us in the face.
I know. And I mean, we live in a world where we're more digitally connected than ever, but, you know, the rate of loneliness is the highest it's ever been because, as you said, we're not connecting as humans. And now we're entering in a world of the next, you know, part of AI and things like that. And, you know, there's a very big fear there. But I think the one thing that we all do know is that that just means that the human connection is going to have to be stronger. And at the end of the day, that's what we look for, right? Yeah, and I mean, it's because our brains are made for it. Like, we would not have survived as a species out on our own. We have shit natural defenses. The way we have become, our brains are made, is that we need community. We need that. And that's it. Like, we all live in our nuclear houses here and all that. Whereas I've got friends, went to the same school, they now don't live in Australia. They live with their family. That's what you do. You know, you live at home with the grandparents and you do that. And for us, we go, oh God, that'd be so weird and so hard. Well, it's not. It's actually beautiful. Yeah. You know, you might have designed it in a certain way. You've all got a bit of space. But there's just such a connection there. And I know there's multiple studies that have been done as well with, you know, and this is from a building and design point of view, of connecting childcare centres with, you know, aged care or retirement living. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing too. And I'm sure that was one of the things we probably talked about, is that connection, the community is so important. I went to boarding school and I often think, oh, when I go to a nursing home, it's just like be going back to boarding school again.
Yeah, well, in an ideal world, you won't be going to a nursing home, will you?
Hopefully, we'll see about that type of stuff. But in essence, like, I know what your message is around community. And I think that that's, you know, we've put into context because of my profession into a corporate world, but really it is about knowing your neighbours, right? Like, how many of us know the 10 people down the street, and how many of us can, you know, have the kids over and do that? And I think that's one of the things that's also changed in Australia over the years, is that we don't, like, I'm fortunate, my friends who live up the road, they literally have the kids next door and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody's there and connected, but we don't have people over. It's a weird thing to talk to your neighbours sometimes, or to connect with them, to communicate. And I think that's why probably people in regional centres love regional centres, because the sense of community is so high too. But it doesn't mean that we can't do that internally. So I think your words around bonds is exceptionally important. And I thought that was a beautiful quote, by the way, and I think there's a lot of takeaways there. I reckon, Marcus, you and I could talk on this for the next 3 hours, but we've been here for 45 minutes almost. I think particularly you've got a very interesting background. There's some fantastic things there. I would recommend to anybody listening, definitely check out your book. It sounds like an absolute ripper as well. And is there any other ways that people can follow or listen to you and, you know, get a bit further insights into some of this?
Yeah, sure. If they want the quick, almost a cheat sheet, they could just go onto my website, marcuspearce.com.au, and do the exceptional life quiz. You essentially just answer 8 questions, rate each of the 8 areas of life out of 10. And what I would always recommend is that you start your life design on the weakest area, because the highest scores are kind of in automatic mode, and the weakest scores are a bit like a 16-year-old driver in a manual car not knowing what a clutch is, and it's clunky. Life will bite you where it hurts when you have weaker scores. You know, Seton, you already said you're good at movement, you know, so movement's not the thing. Everyone's tempted to kind of make,
I'm going to be doing this quiz soon, so I'll soon know what mine is. After this.
But the key to really nailing life as brutal as it sounds, is to be exceptional in all eight, because the one that you accept mediocrity in or sweep under the carpet is the one that comes and tears down every other seven.
Yeah.
You know, dementia is a perfect example of that. It creates an emotional, financial, family cascade that no amount of money can prepare you for. So we've got to be really mindful that one area can dictate all the other areas that you've worked so hard to make awesome.
And I think that is, it is about that balance, isn't it? I mean, I'm obviously an athlete, right? So, and rower, busted my back in my 20s. The one thing was, is because you're only as strong as your weakest link.
Mm.
And so my core wasn't strong enough. So that's the part that goes, and it can have replications. So absolutely, it can't be that everything's in it. It's kind of got to, you're better to be getting probably fives out of everything than you are to get eights and nines and ones and twos out of a few of them. Is that right?
Oh, again, we might be here for another 45 minutes, but sometimes fives is the hardest place to be in, because it's not so bad that you're going to change it, but it's not so good that you know you're still hitting a double bogey on every hole. So it's a tricky, this self-reflection is interesting, because when you've got eights and nines, but then you've got a glaring two or three, it's so easy to know where the focus needs to be. If you've got fives across the board, it's like, well, which one do I start making an effort on? Do I start on my marriage? Do I find a job that's more fulfilling? Do I focus on one-on-one time with my kids? Do I need to get up an hour earlier to start moving? Yeah. But if people fill out the quiz.
And that must be why one of the things, because you also run coaching as well. You've got a coaching program as well. So also something, if people are feeling like we're not to start, great way to start with the quiz. And then if you're feeling like, oh, I'm kind of giving a go, and you look at yourself and you think, oh, that's, I'm not quite sure. Yeah. You know, sometimes it's having somebody who's giving you a bit of guidance on that journey as well can actually get you there. You know, it's like you want to make it something, you do it. If you've got a coach, they can help you to get there a hell of a lot faster than when you're trying to do it yourself and do those types of things.
As much as we're fiercely independent people and we want to do it all ourselves, we have to sometimes acknowledge that
we've
been
trying
to do it for 20 years, you know, and I'm like that, you know, so I'm always very, I understand that process of, if you do get a mentor or a coach, it's always a big gulp of vulnerability and acknowledging that you need some help in something. But I said to someone the other day, it's like, we don't seem to have a problem getting an accountant to help us with our tax returns. But if it comes to a executive coach, a business coach, a life coach, in my words, you know, a longevity coach, it's like, yeah, we seem to think that we should be able to figure this stuff out ourselves.
I agree. It's just about expediting. I think that's one of the guy who wrote Rich Dad for Poor Dad. His number one thing is just get people who help you to be there, you know. That's what they say absolutely. About Ford. That's how he became successful. He's like, I don't need to know that. I've got other people to do that for me.
Yeah.
So excellent, Marcus. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy. Is there any other words of wisdom or things that you would say outside of yours as some things that you would give for people to have a look into if they're interested
in sharing? I have a dear friend, Bronnie Ware, who wrote The Top Five Regrets of the Dying. It's the fastest translated book in the history of Hay House publishing, faster than Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer, 29 languages in the blink of an eye, just after she'd had her daughter, Eleanor. And Bronnie was a carer looking after people who were dying, and what she identified in the deep and meaningful conversations that she had with these people, that, and these were conversations that the family walked on eggshells because they didn't want to acknowledge that the family member was dying, you know, and these dying people want to talk about their lessons learned.
All right, Marcus, is there any other tips or content or other things that you would recommend for people who are interested in this particular area?
I am a reader, voracious reader. One of my dear friends, Bronnie Ware, wrote a great book called The Top Five Regrets of the Dying, and this is a book that became the fastest translated book in Hay House history, faster than Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer, translated into 29 languages in the blink of an eye shortly after she gave birth to her daughter, Eleanor. And it's interesting to me why this hit a nerve with so many people around the world. Bronnie looked after dying people for years. I think it was about 8 years. And she had these deep and meaningful conversations with people that they wanted to have them with their family, but like a lot of the time when people are dying, the family walks on eggshells and they keep the conversation so surface level. And so Bronnie would have these deep and meaningful conversations. And what became glaringly obvious from a thematic perspective is that the number one regret of the human being is that I wish I lived my life according to my own expectations rather than the expectations that everyone else had of me. You know, my mum, my dad, my boss, my teachers, my spouse, my kids, my friends, and so on. And it's a really important point, because anyone that knows me, I'm always saying how selfish I am, and I'm always encouraging others to be more selfish because we've become toxically selfless. I think altruism is a bit of a word, but I'm not talking about, you know, caring about other people. Yeah, I'm talking about doing everything for everyone and nothing for yourself to the point where you resent it. And then over time you regret it. Bronnie has a great conversation around this, around whilst you're alive, you have the ability to turn your regrets into mistakes and you can learn from your mistakes. But if you continue to regret things without doing anything about them, you will take those regrets to the grave and that'll be no fun for anyone. And so if you're looking for a deep and meaningful add-on to this conversation, Seton, I would highly recommend anyone go and buy Bronnie's book. It's an incredible book, Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, and it will pierce you in your heart, but for all the right reasons. And highly recommend, you know, go and listen to Bronnie being interviewed, you know, whether it's on The Imperfects. So she doesn't do a lot of interviews these days, but when she does, it's with the big boys and girls, you know, Marie Forleo, Chatterjee, Gabor Mate, The Imperfects here in Australia. Go and listen to her.
Yeah.
We interviewed her many years ago on 100 Not Out, but I think it's a very wise thing in someone's life to be aware of the type of work that Bronnie Ware does.
No, fantastic. Thank you so much for that. That's great. And I mean, I think that's the thing. You never want to regret anything you want to do. Maybe it's mine. I've always had a philosophy. You come into this world alone, which, you know, your parents are there, and you leave this world alone. The only one person who's going to be in your life is you. So you have to be happy with what you're doing with that. And that doesn't mean not caring about others and not being part of that. We've just talked about bonds and community, but the one person who will be there at the end is going to be you. So you need to be accountable to yourself, not to everybody else in your life as well. So I think they're great insights as well. So thank you so much, Marcus, for all your time. It's been exceptionally interesting. You know, we could talk forever on this. It's a massive interest area for me as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Seton.
My pleasure. I absolutely loved this episode. It was fantastic. I am a big one into longevity and how we actually live very happy lives. One of the things that I found very interesting out of this was that life is not about being busy. How do we actually take time? There are some great takeaways out of this. I hope you've really enjoyed it. And if, like me, you'll be checking out his book. And also, I really think that quiz sounds fantastic. So thank you so much for listening.